My name is Pardut Kynes, the Imperial Planetologist assigned to Arrakis. He looked down at his blood-smeared skin and decided not to extend a hand in greeting. In their culture, they might misinterpret the gesture. I'm very pleased to introduce myself. I've always wanted to meet the Freeman. It's easier to be terrified by an enemy you admire. Thufir Hawat, Mentat, and security commander to House Atreides. Hidden by the thick pines, Duncan Idaho knelt in the soft needles on the ground, feeling little warmth. The chill night air deadened the resinous evergreen scent, but at least here he was sheltered from the razor breezes. He had gone far enough from the cave that he could pause and catch his breath, for just a moment. He knew the Harkonnen hunters wouldn't rest, though. They would be particularly incensed now that he'd killed one of their party. Maybe, he thought, they might even enjoy the chase more, especially Raban. Duncan opened the med pack he'd stolen from the ambushed tracker and brought out a small package of new skin ointment, which he slathered over the incision on his shoulder, where it hardened to an organic bond. Then he wolfed down the nutrition bar and stuffed the wrappings into his pockets. Using the glow of his handlight, he turned to study the laser gun. He'd never fired such a weapon before, but he had watched the guards and the hunters operate their rifles. He cradled the weapon and fiddled with its mechanisms and controls. Pointing the barrel upward, he attempted to understand what he was supposed to do. He had to learn if he meant to fight. With a sudden surge of power, a white-hot beam lanced out toward the upper boughs of the pine trees. They burst into flames, crackling and snapping. Smoldering clumps of evergreen needles fell around him like red-hot snow. Yelping, he dropped the gun to the ground and scrambled backward. But he snatched it up again before he could forget which combination of buttons he had pushed. He had to remember and know how to use them. The flames overhead flared like a bonfire beacon, exuding curls of sharp smoke. With nothing to lose now, Duncan fired again, aiming this time, just to make sure he could use the laser gun to defend himself. The cumbersome weapon was not built for a small boy, especially not with his throbbing shoulder and sore ribs. But he could use it. He had to. Knowing the Harkonnens would run toward the blaze, Duncan scampered out of the trees, searching for another place to hide. Once again he made for higher ground, keeping to the ridge line so he could continue observing the hunting party's scattered glow globes. He knew exactly where the men were, exactly how close. But how can they be so stupid, he wondered, making themselves so obvious? Overconfidence, was that their flaw? If so, it might help him. The Harkonnens expected him to play their game, then cower and die when he was supposed to. Duncan would just have to disappoint them. Maybe this time we'll play my game instead. As he dashed along, he avoided patches of snow and kept away from noisy underbrush. However, Duncan's focus on the clustered pursuers distracted him from seeing his real danger. He heard a snap of dried twigs behind and above him, the rustle of bushes, then the clicking of claws on bare rock accompanied by heavy, hoarse panting. This was no Harkonnen hunter at all, but another forest predator that smelled his blood. Skidding to a halt, Duncan looked up, searching for gleaming eyes in the shadows. But he didn't turn to the stark outcropping over his head until he heard a wet-sounding growl. In the starlight, he discerned the muscular crouching form of a wild gazehound, its back fur bristling like quills, its lips curled to expose flesh-tearing fangs, its huge, huge eyes focused on its prey. A young boy with tender skin. Duncan scrambled backward and fired off a shot with the laser gun. Poorly aimed, the beam came nowhere close to the stalking creature. but powdered rock spewed from the outcropping below the gaze hound. The predator yelped and snarled, backing off. Duncan fired again, this time sizzling a blackened hole through its right haunch. With a brassy roar, the creature bounded off into the darkness, howling and baying. The gaze hound's racket, as well as flashes from the laser gun fire, would draw the Harkonnen trackers. Duncan set off into the starlight, running once more. Hands on his hips, Raban stared down at the body of his ambushed hunter by the cave hollow. Rage burned through him, as well as cruel satisfaction. The devious child had lured the man into a trap. Very resourceful. All of the tracker's armor hadn't saved him from a dropped boulder and then the thrust of a dull dagger into his throat. The coup de grace. Raban simmered for a few moments, trying to assess the challenge. He smelled the sour scent of death even in the cold night. This was what he wanted, wasn't it? A challenge? One of the other trackers crawled into the low hollow and played the beam of his handlight around the cave. It lighted the smears of blood and the smashed Richesian tracer. "Here is the reason, my lord. The cub cut out his own tracking device." The hunter swallowed, as if uncertain whether he should continue. "A smart one, this boy. Good prey." Raban glowered at the carnage for a few moments, his sunburn still stung on his cheeks. Then he grinned, slowly, and finally burst out into loud guffaws. "An 8-year-old child with only his imagination and a couple of clumsy weapons bested one of my troops." He laughed again. Outside, the others in the party stood uncertainly, bathed in the light of their bobbing glow globes. "Such a boy was made for the hunt," Raban declared. Then he nudged the dead tracker's body with the toe of his boot. "And this clod did not deserve to be part of my crew. Leave his body here to rot. Let the scavengers get him." Then two of the spotters saw flames in the trees, and Raban pointed. "There, the cub's probably trying to warm his hands." He laughed again, and finally the rest of the hunting crew snickered along with him. "This is turning into an exciting night." From his high vantage, Duncan gazed into the distance, away from the guarded lodge. A bright light blinked on and off, paused, then 15 seconds later flashed on and off again. Some kind of signal, separate from the Harkonnen hunters, far from the lodge or the station or any nearby settlements. Duncan turned, curious. The light flashed, then fell dark. Who else is out here? Forest Guard Station was a restricted preserve for the sole use of Harkonnen family members. Anyone discovered trespassing would be killed outright or used as prey in a future hunt. Duncan watched the tantalizing light flickering on and off. It was clearly a message. Who's sending it? He took a deep breath, felt small but defiant in a very large and hostile world. He had no place else to go, no other chance. So far, he had eluded the hunters. But that couldn't last forever. Soon the Harkonnens would bring in additional forces, ornithopters, life tracers, perhaps even hunting animals to follow the smell of blood on his shirt, as the wild gazehound had done. Duncan decided to make his way to the mysterious signaler and hope for the best. He couldn't imagine finding anyone to help him, but he had not given up hope. Maybe he could find a means of escape, perhaps as a stowaway. First, though, he would lay another trap for the hunters. He had an idea, something that would surprise them, and it seemed simple enough. If he could kill a few more of the enemy, he'd have a better chance of getting away. After studying the rocks, the patches of snow, the trees, Duncan selected the best point for his second ambush. He switched on his handlight and directed the beam at the ground so that no sensitive eyes would spot a telltale gleam in the distance. The pursuers weren't far behind him. Occasionally, he heard a muffled shout in the deep silence, saw the hunting party's firefly glow globes illuminating their way through the forest as the trackers tried to anticipate the path their quarry would take. Right then, Duncan wanted them to anticipate where he would go. But they would never guess what he meant to do. Kneeling beside a particularly light and fluffy snowdrift, he inserted the handlight into the snow and pushed it down through the cold iciness as far as he could. Then he withdrew his hand. The glow reflected from the white snow like water diffusing into a sponge. Tiny crystals of ice refracted the light, magnifying it. The drift itself shone like a phosphorescent island in the dark clearing. Slinging the laser gun in front of him, ready to fire, he trotted back to the sheltering trees. He lay on a cushion of pine needles flat against the ground, careful to present no visible target, then rested the barrel of the laser gun on a small rock, propping it in position. Waiting. The hunters came, predictably, and Duncan felt that their roles had reversed. Now he was the hunter, and they were his game. He aimed the weapon, fingers tense on the firing stud. At last the group entered the clearing. Startled to find the shining snowdrift, they milled about, trying to figure out what it was, what their prey had done. Two of the trackers faced outward, suspicious of an attack from the forest. Others stood silhouetted in the ghostly light, perfect targets, exactly as Duncan had hoped. At the rear of the party, he recognized one burly man with a commanding presence. Rabban. Duncan thought of how his parents had fallen, remembered the smell of their burning flesh, and squeezed the firing stud. But at that moment, one of the scouts stepped in front of Rabban to give a report. The beam scored through his armor, burning and smoking. The man flung out his arms and gave a wild shriek. Reacting with lightning speed for his burly body, Rabban hurled himself to one side as the beam melted all the way through the hunter's padded chest and sizzled into the snowdrift. Duncan cut loose another blast, shooting a second tracker who stood outlined against the glowing snow. Then the remaining guards began firing wildly into the trees, into the darkness. Duncan next targeted the drifting glow globes. Bursting one after another, he left his hapless pursuers alone in flame-haunted darkness. He picked off two more men, while the rest of the party scrambled for cover. With the charge in his laser gun running low, the boy scrabbled back behind the ridge where he had set up his attack, and then he headed out at top speed toward the blinking signal light he had seen. Whatever the beacon might be, it was his best chance. The Harkonnens would be startled and disorganized for a few moments, and overly suspicious for much longer than that. Knowing he had one last opportunity, Duncan threw caution to the wind. He ran, slipping, down the hillside, smashing against rocks, but taking no time to feel the pain of scrapes or bruises. He could not cover his tracks in time, did not attempt to hide. Somewhere behind him, as he increased the distance, he heard muffled growls and snarls, and shouts from the hunters. A pack of the wild gaze hounds had converged on them, seeking wounded prey. Duncan hid a smile and continued toward the intermittently blinking light. He saw it now, up ahead near the edge of the forest preserve. He finally approached, treading lightly toward a shallow clearing. He came upon a silent flitterthopter, a high-speed aircraft that could take several passengers. The flashing beacon signaled from the top of the craft, but Duncan saw no one. He waited in silence for a few moments, then cautiously left the shadows of the trees and moved forward. Was the craft abandoned? Left there for him? Some kind of trap the Harkonnens had laid? But why would they do that? They were already hunting him. Or did he have a mysterious rescuer? Duncan Idaho had accomplished much this evening and was already exhausted, stunned at how much had changed in his life. but he was only 8 years old and could never pilot this flitter, even if it was his only way to escape. Still, he might find supplies inside, more food, another weapon. He leaned against the hull, surveying the area, making no sound. The hatch stood open like an invitation, but the mysterious flitter was dark inside. Wishing he still had his handlight, he moved forward cautiously and probed the shadows ahead of him with the barrel of the laser gun. Then hands snatched out from the shadows of the craft to yank the gun from his grip before he could even flinch. Fingers stinging, flesh torn, Duncan staggered backward, biting back an outcry. The person inside the flitter tossed the laser gun with a clatter onto the deck plates and lunged out to grab hold of the boy's arms. Rough hands squeezed the wound in his shoulder and made him gasp in pain. Duncan kicked and struggled, then looked up to see a wiry, bitter-faced woman with chocolate-colored hair and dusky skin. He recognized her instantly, Janice Milam, who had stood next to him during the yard games. Just before Harkonnen troops had captured his parents and sent his entire family to the prison city of Barony. This woman had betrayed him to the Harkonnens. Janice pressed a hand over his mouth before he could cry out, and clamped his head in a firm armlock. He couldn't escape. "Got you," she said, her voice a harsh whisper. She had betrayed him again. We consider the various worlds as gene pools, sources of teachings and teachers, sources of the possible. Bene Gesserit Analysis, Wallach 9 Archives. Baron Vladimir Harkonnen was no stranger to despicable acts. Still, being coerced into this encounter disturbed him more than any vile situation he had ever been in. It threw him completely off balance. And throughout it all, why did this damned Reverend Mother have to be so calm, so smug? Embarrassed, he sent away his guards and officials, purging all possible eavesdroppers from the brooding Harkonnen citadel. "Where is Rabban when I need him? Off on a hunt?" He sulked back to his private chambers, as ready as he would ever be. His stomach churned. Nervous sweat glistened on his forehead as he stepped through the ornate arched doorway, then flicked on the privacy curtains. Perhaps if he extinguished the glow globes and pretended he was doing something else. When he entered, the Baron was relieved to see that the witch had not taken off her clothes, had not reclined seductively on the mussed bed coverings in anticipation of his return. Instead, she sat fully robed, a prim Bene Gesserit sister, just waiting for him. But a maddeningly superior smile curved her lips. The Baron wanted to slash that smile away with a sharp instrument. He took a deep breath, appalled that this witch could make him feel so helpless. "The best I can offer you is a vial of my sperm," he said, trying to be gruff and in control. "Impregnate yourself. That should be sufficient for your purposes." He lifted his firm chin. "You Bene Gesserit will just have to accept that."
"But it's not acceptable, Baron," the Reverend Mother said, sitting up straighter on the divan. "You know the strictures. We're not Tlaloxu growing offspring in tanks. We Bene Gesserit must have birth through natural processes, with no artificial meddling, for reasons you're incapable of understanding."
"I'm capable of understanding plenty," the Baron growled.
"Not this, you aren't."
He hadn't expected the gambit to work anyway. "You need Harkonnen blood? What about my nephew, Glossu Rabban? Or better yet, his father, Abelard? Go to Lankavile, and you could have as many children as you want through him. You won't have to work so hard."
"Unacceptable," Mohiam said. She fixed him with a cold, narrow-lidded glare.
Her face looked plain, pasty, and implacable.
I am not here to negotiate, Baron. I have my orders. I must return to Wallach 9 carrying your child.
But what if... The witch held up her hand.
I've made it perfectly clear what will happen if you refuse. Make your decision. We'll have you either way.
His private chamber had suddenly become an alien and threatening place to him. He squared his shoulders, flexed his biceps. Though a muscular man, lean of body, with fast reflexes, his only escape seemed to involve pummeling this woman into submission. But he also knew about Bene Gesserit fighting abilities, especially their arcane weirding ways, and felt a twinge of doubt as to whether he would be the victor in such a struggle. She got up and glided across the room with silent steps, then sat rigidly on the edge of the Baron's stained and unmade bed.
If it's any consolation, I take no more pleasure in this act than you do.
She looked at the Baron's well-made body, his broad shoulders, his firm pectorals and flat abdomen. His face had a haughty look, clearly noble-born. In other circumstances, Vladimir Harkonnen might even have been an acceptable lover, like the male trainers with whom the Bene Gesserit had matched Mohiam throughout her childbearing years. She had already delivered 8 daughters to the Bene Gesserit school, all of them raised apart from her on Wallach 9 or on other training planets. Mohiam had never tried to follow their progress. That was not the sisterhood's way. Her daughter by Baron Harkonnen would be no different. Like many well-trained sisters, Mohiam had the ability to manipulate her most minute bodily functions. In order to become a reverend mother, she had been required to alter her own biochemistry by taking an awareness spectrum poison. In transmuting the deadly drug within herself, she had passed inward through the long echoing bloodlines, enabling conversation with all of her female ancestors, the clamorous inner lives of other memory. She could prepare her womb, ovulate at will, even choose the sex of her child from the moment the sperm and egg united. The Bene Gesserit wanted a daughter from her, a Harkonnen daughter, and Mohiam would deliver as instructed. With only limited details of the numerous breeding programs, Mohiam did not understand why the Bene Gesserit needed this particular combination of genes, why she had been selected to bear the child, and why no other Harkonnen could produce a viable offspring for Bene Gesserit plans. She was just doing her duty. To her, the Baron was a tool, a sperm donor who had to play his part. Mohiam lifted her dark skirt and lay back on the bed, propping her head up to look at him.
Come, Baron, let us waste no more time. After all, it's such a small thing.
She let her gaze drop down to his crotch. As he flushed with rage, she continued in a soft voice,
I have the ability to increase your pleasure or to deaden it. Either way, the results will be the same to us.
She smiled with her thin lips.
Just think of the hidden melange stockpiles you'll be able to keep without the Emperor's knowledge.
Her voice grew harder. On the other hand, just try to imagine what old Elrud will do to House Harkonnen if he finds out you've been cheating him all along. Scowling, the Baron fumbled with his robe and lurched toward the bed. Mohiam closed her eyes and muttered a Bene Gesserit benediction, a prayer to calm herself and to focus her bodily actions and her inner metabolism. The Baron was more nauseated than aroused. He couldn't bear to look at Mohiam's naked form. Fortunately, she kept most of her clothes on, as did he. She worked with her fingers until he stiffened, and he kept his eyes closed during the entire mechanical act. Behind his eyes, he had no choice but to fantasize about earlier conquests, the pain, the power,
anything to take his mind from the revolting and messy act of male-female intercourse. It wasn't love-making by any means, just a tired ritual between two bodies in order to exchange genetic material. For both of them, it was barely even sex. But Mohiam got what she wanted. At his one-way private observation window, Peter DeVries moved silently, surreptitiously. As a mentat, he had learned how to glide like a shadow, how to see without being seen. An ancient law of physics claimed that the mere act of observation changed parameters. But any good mentat knew how to observe broader issues while remaining invisible, unknown to the subjects of his scrutiny. DeVries had often watched the Baron's sexual escapades through this peephole. Sometimes the acts disgusted him. Occasionally they fascinated. And rarer still, they gave the mentat ideas of his own. Now he silently kept his eyes to the tiny observation holes, drinking in details as the Baron was forced to copulate with the Bene Gesserit witch. He watched his master with great amusement, enjoying the man's utter discomfiture. He had never seen the Baron so nonplussed. Oh, how he wished he had found time to set up the recording apparatus, so he could enjoy this again and again. The moment she'd made her demands, DeVries had known the unavoidable outcome. The Baron had been a perfect pawn, utterly ensnared, with no choice in the matter. But why? Even with his great mentat prowess, DeVries could not understand what the sisterhood wanted with House Harkonnen or its offspring. Surely the genetics weren't that spectacular. For now, though, Peter DeVries just enjoyed the show. Many inventions have selectively improved particular skills or abilities, emphasizing one aspect or another. But no achievement has ever scratched the complexity or adaptability of the human mind. Iqbal's Treatise on the Mind, Volume 2. On one side of the faux stone practice floor in the Ixion Grand Palais, Leto stood beside Guard Captain Jaz, panting. The fight instructor was an angular man with bristly brown hair, thick eyebrows, and a square-cut beard. Like his students, Jaz wore no shirt, only beige fighting shorts. The smell of sweat and hot metal hung in the air, despite the best efforts of an air exchange apparatus. As on most mornings, though, the training master spent more time watching than fighting. He let the battle machines do all the work. After his regular studies, Leto loved the change of pace, the physical exercise, the challenge.
Well, he the boy remember no one that's up so mad as fizzer.
Fought the mech twice that day, defeating it each time on higher difficulty settings than Prince Romber was using. When Jaws asked how Leto had acquired such skills, the young Atreides hadn't said much, not wishing to brag. But now he had first-hand proof that the Atreides' method of training was superior, despite the mech's chilling near-intelligence. Leto's background involved rapiers, knives, slow-pellet stunners, and body shields. And Thufir Hawat was a more dangerous and unpredictable instructor than any automated device could ever hope to be. Just as Leto took up his own weapon and prepared for the next round, the lift doors opened and Kylea entered, sparkling with jewels and a comfortable metal fiber outfit whose design seemed calculated to look gorgeous but casual. She bore a stylus and Redulian recorder pad. Her eyebrows arched in feigned surprise at finding them there.
"Oh, excuse me. I came to look at the mech design."
The Vernius daughter usually contented herself with intellectual and cultural pursuits, studying business and art. Leto couldn't keep himself from watching her. At times her eyes almost seemed to flirt with him, but more often she ignored him with such intensity he suspected she shared the same attraction he felt. During his time in the Grand Palais, Leto had crossed her path in the dining hall, on the open observation balconies, in library facilities. He had responded to her with snatches of awkward conversation. Aside from the inviting sparkle in her beautiful green eyes, Kylea had given him no special encouragement, but he couldn't stop thinking about her. "She's only a stripling," Leto reminded himself, "playing at being a lady." Somehow, though, he couldn't convince his imagination of that. Kylea had complete confidence that she was destined for a greater future than living underground on Ix. Her father was a war hero, the head of one of the wealthiest great houses, and her mother had been beautiful enough to be an imperial concubine. And the girl herself had an excellent head for business. Kylea Vernius obviously had a wealth of possibilities. She focused her complete attention on the motionless gray ovoid.
"I've gotten father to consider marketing our new phase fighting mechs commercially."
She studied the motionless training machine, but glanced at Leto out of the corner of her eye, noted his strong profile and regal, high-bridged nose.
"Ours are better than any other combat device, adaptable, versatile, and self-learning. The closest thing to a human adversary developed since the jihad. He felt a chill, thinking back to all the warnings his mother had given him. Right now she would be pointing an accusing finger and nodding in satisfaction. Leto looked over at the charcoal-colored ovoid.
Are you saying that thing has a brain?
By all the saints and sinners, you mean in violation of the strictures after the Great Revolt?
Captain Jaws replied in stern surprise.
Thou shalt not make a machine in the likeness of the human mind.
We're very careful about that, Leto, Romber said, using a purple towel to wipe sweat from the back of his neck.
Nothing to worry about.
Leto didn't back down.
Well, if the mech scans people, if it reads them as you said, how does it process the information? If not through a computer brain, then how?
This isn't just a reactive device. It learns and tailors its attack. Kylia jotted notes down on her crystal pad and adjusted one of the gold combs in her copper-dark hair.
There are many gray areas, Leto. And if we tread very carefully, House Vernia stands to make a tremendous profit.
She ran a fingertip along her curved lips.
Still, it might be best to test the waters by offering some unmarked models on the black market first.
Don't trouble yourself, Leto, Romber said, avoiding the uncomfortable subject. His tousled blonde hair still dripped with sweat, and his skin showed a flush from his exertion.
House Vernius has teams of mentats and legal advisers scrutinizing the letter of the law.
He looked over at his sister for reassurance. She nodded absently.
In some of his instruction sessions in the Grand Palais, Leto had learned of interplanetary patent disputes, minor technicalities, subtle loopholes. Had the Ixians come up with a substantially different way of using mechanical units to process data, one that did not raise the specter of thinking machines like those that had enslaved mankind for so many centuries? He didn't see how House Vernius could have created a self-learning, reactive, adaptable fighting mech without somehow going over the line into jihad violation.
If his mother ever found out, she would haul him home from Ix, no matter what his father might say.
Let's see just how good this product is, Leto said, taking up a weapon and turning his back on Kylia.
He could feel her eyes on his bare shoulders, the muscles of his neck. Jaz stood back casually to watch.
Leto shifted his pike from hand to hand and jogged onto the floor. Taking a classic fighting stance, he called out a degree of difficulty to the charcoal oval shape.
7.24.
8 notches higher than the time before. The mech refused to move.
Too high, the training master said, thrusting his bearded chin forward. I disabled the dangerous higher levels.
Leto scowled.
The fight instructor did not want to challenge his students or risk more than the slightest injury.
Thufir Hawat would have laughed out loud.
Are you trying to show off for the young lady, Master Atreides? Could get you killed.
Looking at Kylia, he saw her watching him, a bemused, teasing expression on her face. She quickly turned to the Redulian pad and scratched a few more ciphers. He flushed, felt the hotness. Jaz reached over to grab a soft towel from a rack and tossed it to Leto.
The session's over. Distractions of this sort are not good for your training, and can lead to serious injury.
He turned to the princess.
Lady Kylia, I request that you avoid the training floor whenever Leto Atreides is fighting our mechs. Too many hormones in the way.
The guard captain could not cover his amusement.
Your presence could be more dangerous than any enemy.
We must do a thing on Arrakis never before attempted for an entire planet. We must use man as a constructive ecological force, inserting adapted terraform life. A plant here, an animal there, a man in that place, to transform the water cycle,
to build a new kind of landscape. Report from Imperial Planetologist Pardit Kynes. Directed to Padishah Emperor Elrud IX. Unsent. When the blood-spattered Freeman youths asked Pardit Kynes to accompany them, he didn't know whether he was to be their guest or prisoner. Either way, the prospect intrigued him. Finally, he would have his chance to experience their mysterious culture firsthand. One of the young men quickly and efficiently carried his injured companion over to Kynes's small ground car. The other Freeman reached into the back storage compartments and tossed out Kynes's painstakingly collected geological samples to make more room. The planetologist was too astonished to object. Besides, he didn't want to alienate these people. He wanted to learn more about them. In moments, they had stuffed the bodies of the dead Harkonnen Bravos into the bins, no doubt for some Freeman purpose. Perhaps a further ritual desecration of their enemies. He ruled out the unlikely possibility that the youths simply wished to bury the dead. Are they hiding the bodies for fear of reprisals? That, too, seemed wrong somehow, not in keeping with what little he had heard about Freeman. Or will these desert folk render them for resources, reclaiming the water in their tissues? Then, without asking, without giving thanks or making any comment whatsoever, the first grim Freeman youth took the vehicle, its injured passenger, and the bodies, and drove off rapidly, spewing sand and dust in all directions. Kynes watched it go, along with his desert survival kit and maps, including many he had prepared himself. He found himself alone with the third young man, a guard or a friend. If these freemen meant to strand him without his supplies, he would be dead before long. Perhaps he could get his bearings and make it back to the village of Windsack on foot. But he had paid little attention to the locations of population centers during his recent wanderings. An inauspicious end for an Imperial planetologist, he thought. Or perhaps the young men he'd rescued wanted something else from him. Because of his own newly formed dreams for the future of Arrakis, Kynes desperately wanted to know the Freeman and their unorthodox ways. Clearly, these people were a valuable secret hidden from Imperial eyes. He thought they'd be sure to greet him with enthusiasm once he told them his ideas. The remaining Freeman youth used a small patch kit to repair a fabric rip on the leg of his stillsuit, then said, "Come with me." He turned toward a sheer rock wall a short distance away. "Follow, or you'll die out here." He flashed an indigo-eyed glare over his shoulder. His face held a hard humor, an impish smile as he said, "Do you think the Harkonnens will take long to seek vengeance for their dead?" Kynes hurried to him. "Wait, you haven't told me your name." The young man looked at him strangely. He had the blue-within-blue eyes of long spice addiction, and weathered skin that gave him an appearance of age far beyond his years. "Is it worthwhile to exchange names? The Freemen already know who you are." Kynes blinked. "Well, I did just save your life and the lives of your companions. Doesn't that count for something among your people? It does in most societies." The young man seemed startled, then resigned.